Today is Monday, May 16th, 2011. I'm Martin Lemelin, and this is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening, it's 5:05 and time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to provide in-depth coverage of the HSD, presenting the pros and cons in an effort to allow you to make an educated decision in next month's referendum. We'll also take a look at the pending Supreme Court decision that will see whether the East Side's InSight program falls under federal or provincial jurisdiction, as well as the FSRN headlines and arts report with Adam Yanous. All this plus your weekly weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
And now, Abram, headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Dozens of laborers in Guatemala were brutally tortured, murdered, and decapitated yesterday on a coconut farm near the country's border with Mexico. According to a witness, the nearly 200 attackers arrived by bus. Authorities think the massacre is related to the Mexican Los Zetas drug cartel. The farm was owned by Geraldo León. He was killed a day earlier. León's brother, a notorious drug dealer known as Juancho, was killed in 2008. It's widely believed he, too, was assassinated by the Zetas. In Mexico today, burials are being held for indigenous people who were massacred in Oaxaca over the weekend in what has been described as an electoral dispute. Shannon Young has more from Oaxaca City.
10 people died and another 8 were left wounded when members of 2 indigenous communities were ambushed by gunmen Saturday en route to the town of Chuapan in Oaxaca. They had been traveling to what is, in practice, the rural area's county seat to witness the inauguration of a new electoral council. Police reports indicate the ambush occurred at a spot in the road that had been blocked by large mounds of dirt. 3 of the trucks the victims were traveling in were set on fire. A dispute has been festering in Chuapan since December, when a local election was annulled due to irregularities. While the conflict may go beyond the simple politics of which political faction controls the town, details have been sparse. Chuapan is located near Oaxaca's border with Veracruz, an area that has experienced its share of drug violence. In the state capital, the incident has led to furious finger-pointing between members of the new reformist government and the party that controlled the state's politics for 8 decades. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca City.
The humanitarian situation in several Syrian cities continues to deteriorate. In Taqala, government forces say they're battling Islamic extremists. Locals, however, say pro-government fighters seek to quash the popular uprising, adding that conditions there are catastrophic. The National Organization for Human Rights said today that residents are permitted to leave their homes for just 2 hours each day, and that today they discovered a mass grave. There's no word on the number of dead. Opposition leaders refuse to engage in talks, saying dialogue is unacceptable until the violence and repression ends and political prisoners are set free. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to resurrect a case filed against Jeppesen Data Plan over post-9/11 secret rendition. 5 people who claim they were spirited out of the country, taken to secret prisons, and tortured, tried to sue the Boeing offshoot for its role in their transport. The suit had been dismissed on the basis that state secrets would be revealed if the case moved forward. The UK-based Environmental Investigation Agency, or EIA, says it has uncovered a highly lucrative international electronic waste black market under which large quantities of harmful wastes are being shipped from Europe to Africa. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
In a report issued today, the Environmental Investigation Agency said key players in large organizations, local councils, and even major central government institutions in the United Kingdom are involved in the illegal e-waste trade, despite European Union regulations that require electronic waste be properly recycled rather than exported. E-waste includes old cell phones, TVs, stereos, and computer equipment. The EIA said in the course of an 18-month undercover investigation, electronic equipment broken beyond repair and sent to recycling plants was later tracked to Nigeria and Ghana. The EIA says when such unstable electronic items are shipped to Africa, poor children trying to earn money from their components break them down and in the process are exposed to toxic substances which can damage such vital organs like their brain, kidney, nervous and blood systems. They called for the UK to nationalize e-waste recycling contracts to ensure e-waste is not exported. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to announce today that it's backtracking on final rules it announced in March aimed at cutting mercury, soot, and lead emissions from oil refineries and other factories. The change follows industry outcry over the costs of complying with the rules. According to the EPA, the new rules could have prevented more than 4,000 heart attacks per year by 2014. And Senator John Kerry is in Pakistan today, where he met with President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani. Last night, he talked with the nation's army chief. Diplomatic relations remain tense following the U.S. raid and targeted killing of Osama bin Laden. Kerry clearly stated he was not there to apologize. He said the two sides agreed to a roadmap for the next few months. While Senator Kerry was in Islamabad, 2 drones killed as many as 11 people in North Waziristan. It's unclear if any were civilians. And in Mingora, Pakistani officials questioned a youth who was charged in Florida with financing terrorists. His grandfather, also charged, is an imam in Miami. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Martin Lemlin. In local news, the question is still up in the air. Should Vancouver's drug addicts be shooting up in the streets or under the supervision of a trained nurse? The Supreme Court of Canada has yet to decide whether BC's Insight program is a legitimate healthcare system or not. Insight is a provincially run program that allows illicit drug users to inject their own street drugs under the supervision of a trained medical staff. The federal government is arguing that this service has no health benefit and simply makes it easier for the drug abusers to get high. The BC Supreme Court has already decided that Insight is a legitimate health service that quells the spread of HIV as well as the dangers victims of drug abuse face each day. But Ottawa is not convinced, and the case was brought to the highest court in the land last Thursday. A decision has not yet been reached as members of the BC Nurses Union rally outside the Supreme Court of Canada and anxiously await what could be an indicative decision from a court appointed by our country's first majority government in 7 years. Riding the wave of momentum from the federal election, the BC NDP nearly dealt a severe blow to our new premier. Not even David Eby thought his campaign would come so close to taking the illustrious Point Grey riding in last week's by-election. Christy Clark may have won her leadership bid for the BC Liberals, but as well as the premiership, but she still had to win a popular vote to gain a seat in our province's legislature. Juggling both her duties as premier and the campaign, Clark sort of flew under the radar. Opting out of both all leaders' debates, she preferred to hold her own town hall meetings. NDP candidate David Eby fought a campaign heavily geared towards supplying the Point Grey riding with a full-time MLA. Point Grey has not been represented by the Premier of British Columbia for the past 10 years. But it was not enough. Although it did look like Eby might take the riding at many points throughout the election night, at about 10 p.m., the margin between Clark and Eby was separated by a single vote. But in the end, Clark won by just over 500 votes. Ballots are expected to be finalized and confirmed by Wednesday. Then Premier Clark will be able to take her seat among the Legislative Assembly. The BC Liberals also held a convention in Penticton this weekend. The political party gathered to discuss its position on several key issues, such as the name itself. MLA Colin Hanson brought up the topic of the name change, saying it might be wise to distinguish the fact that the BC Liberals are in no way affiliated with the Federal Liberal Party, and that the likeness could be confusing to voters. Premier Clark also addressed the possibility of amending the harmonized sales tax in an effort to make it more appealing to voters, who will decide next month whether the HST is kept or scrapped, although Clark did not specify what changes she might consider. We're going to be right back with national and international headlines. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin. In national news, it's been raining all over the Lower Mainland, but northern Alberta is already being decimated by wildfires. There are more than 30 fires raging throughout the province, and the small community of Slave Lake is being hit the hardest. The town of 7,000 was ordered to evacuate last night. Nearly half of the homes in the town have been either damaged or destroyed by the blaze. The municipality building and library burned to the ground. Crews are anticipating a heavy couple of days, with high winds and a low pressure system make the possibility of lightning storms very real for both tomorrow and Wednesday. Province's fire crews are asking for as much help as they can get. They have about 900 firefighters on hand, 20 air tankers, and 100 helicopters, but wildfires can turn into unmanageable monsters in seconds, and it's important to extinguish every small flare-up before it gets out of hand. BC fire officials have confirmed that we've sent 129 of our own firefighters to Slave Lake, with an agreement to send them back within 24 hours should their services be needed back home. Now, we've all heard the old adage, fight fire with fire, but what about fight flooding with floods? Manitoba is facing the worst flood season it's ever seen. As the Assiniboine River continues to rise and gain momentum, the province has made the decision to dig an intentional break in the dike, protecting a large area of farmland. This weekend, the province of Manitoba, with military assistance, dug a 20-meter portion out of the dirt road that doubles as a barrier to the Assiniboine River. They're hoping that by allowing a smaller flood that can be controlled, they'll avoid chaos downstream. The Assiniboine River is now flowing at about 500 cubic feet per second, or roughly 1 kilometer every 5 hours. Experts warn the rate could increase of up to 54,000 cubic feet per second, but so far that's not happened. In fact, latest reports show the worst could be over soon. The river is already cresting in Brandon and is expected to peak at the dike breach tomorrow. The New Democratic Party of Canada has managed to wrestle another seat out of Conservative hands. Results in the Mogami-Lillette
Kamouraska, Rivière-du-Loup, Quebec riding have been overturned. On election night, conservative incumbent Bernard Jeanneret was ahead by about 100 votes, but a tabulation error rewarded the same number of votes of NDP votes to the Green Party. And in Canada, when the margin of victory is less than 1/1000th of the number of votes, a superior judge is brought in to oversee a recount. And last Friday, it was confirmed that NDP candidate François Lapointe actually edged out the Conservative by 9 votes, which brings the NDP's seat total up to 104, a tie for the largest official opposition in Canadian history, along with Joe Clark's Tories in 1980. It was announced today that Parliament will resume on June 2nd. In international news, initial reports from Fukushima Daiichi are being called into question. The power plant's first reports claimed meltdowns which took place in 3 reactors in Fukushima were caused by a loss of power to the cooling systems when the tsunami knocked out the backup diesel generator. But new data and inspections of the site are showing that the reactors have suffered much greater damage than first thought, which might force officials to abandon their initial plans of simply shutting down the plant. It's starting to become clear that the reactors were only equipped to handle a 6-magnitude earthquake, and now being investigated, it's now being investigated just how much damage the March 11th 9+ magnitude earthquake actually caused. If it can be conclusively proven that any of the reactors were damaged by the quake itself, it will surely complicate the debate on the future of nuclear power in Japan.
4, 3, 2, 0, and liftoff for the final launch of Endeavour, expanding our knowledge, expanding our lives in space.
That was a scene at 5:56 Pacific time this morning. Space Shuttle Endeavour launched from Cape Canaveral's Mandarin Morning Sky for the last time today. Only 2 weeks after the shuttle's unsuccessful launch attempt, when the mission was postponed 4 hours prior to launch, when an electrical problem was found in the auxiliary power unit. Now, this is the second final launch of the 3 retiring NASA vessels. The first being the Discovery launch in February, the last is Atlantis, which will perform its final mission in July. Endeavour is now on a 16-day mission to deliver spare parts, as well as an alpha magnetic spectrometer, which is a particle physics detector that scientists hope will help lead to the understanding of the origin of the universe. The astronauts aboard Endeavour are scheduled to perform 4 spacewalks and are expected back home by June 1st at the earliest. When the shuttle lands, it will be retired for display at the California Science Center in Los Angeles. Its Canadarm robotic arm is expected to be returned to Canada. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. But I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
It's time to get weird. Weird 3 is a double-stage multi-city music marathon curated by Weird Canada, recently named by CBC Radio 3 as the best indie music website in the country. This traveling caravan features 19 emerging Canadian bands in an explosive happening of audible euphoria. Red Mass, Dirty Beaches, Gobble Gobble, Weird Visions, The Famines, Long Long Long, Hobo Cubes, Femininelli, Velvet Chrome, Feral Children, Silver Dapple, Ketamines, Makeout Videotape, Manic Attracts, Roll Mock, Needles Pins, and Babysitter. It's all going down Sunday, May 22nd at the Waldorf Hotel. Doors at 5:30, music starts at 6. Tickets are available from Zoo Shop on Main Street and online at wyrdiii.eventbrite.com.
Motivation.
Well, the party is off to a good start. Guests are on time. Everyone's out to have fun and to help others fun.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
UBC students have an alternative. Looking to unwind? Check out one of the sub's two licensed establishments.
The Pit Pub and Burger Bar is home of the famous Pit Night. Relax with great prices on cold beer and lots of big screen HD TVs, or chow down on charbroiled burgers, beer battered fish and chips, and Belgian fries. The Pit is open 7 days a week, and Wednesday through Saturday is open late until 2 a.m. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. There's been a lot of debate regarding the HST and its introduction to the BC taxpayers. It's ultimately led to the demise of Gordon Campbell's premiership, leaving Christy Clark to deal with a tax that nobody really can make their minds up about. It's a tax hike, but at this point, wouldn't it be more of a hassle and expenditure to revoke the tax? CITR News is presenting you both sides of the argument, starting with the man who brought forth the petition that resulted in the summer's referendum. I had a chance to speak with former Premier Bill van der Zand this morning and ask him to help clarify this argument against the HST. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. van der Zand. You're obviously not a fan of the HST. What do you think are the tangible consequences of the long-term offense for British Columbians if the tax is kept?
Well, from where I see it, and judging what's happening elsewhere in the world, including Canada, where they have the HST, I think a regressive tax like the HST will not only hurt and eliminate the middle class, but also harm the economy overall. It's happened in Europe, where we find places like Greece having an underground economy that's bigger than the real economy. And it's happening in places like Ireland, Portugal, Spain. It's happening even in places like Denmark and Sweden, where the underground economy has grown so big that not only are these people not collecting the HST, or the VAT, as they call it, but they're also not paying an income tax for fear of getting caught. So I see disaster from the HST, and I'm fighting it for all it's worth.
So you think the tax is ultimately meant to boost an already rich upper class and to keep the middle and lower classes down further?
The HST will help perhaps the upper class, because they have more ways of dealing with it than the people that pack the lunch bucket and go to work every day. And I can also see where the industry will certainly benefit by the HST, and we'll see that over the next number of weeks when they'll pour on millions of dollars in advertising. We live in a province where we do not do a great deal of manufacturing. Most of our resource companies are export-oriented. So the real beneficiaries from a lower price, perhaps, will be people in Asia, the United States, or Europe. It won't be the working person here. They're going to pay more, and a whole lot more than what we're being told by the government and their so-called independent panels.
You've said that the independent panel has grossly underestimated the cost that the HST will have on British Columbian families. What have your studies found?
The impact on BC families will be in the order of, at least, in my view, $1,200 or more per year. The independent, so-called independent panel calculated into their number their belief that somehow businesses would refund the equivalent of 90% of what people will pay in taxes, which is crazy. I haven't seen a price come down yet. Every price is going up. I don't even know how the average person in this province, with all the taxes and all the charges, manages to survive. It's almost impossible.
It must be pretty tough trying to anticipate how much money a particular tax is going to bring in. Technically speaking, how do you go about figuring that out? What is the process?
Well, we have a big Ministry of Finance with a lot of staff, very well paid. They should be able to do calculations a lot more accurately than what we've seen. It's not only that, they can draw on the federal government to help them in their calculations. And it's happened elsewhere before, particularly in the maritime provinces, where they also have the HSD. So there's no excuse for the crazy numbers that they've been coming out with. Government, this government, our government in this province, has not been truthful with us.
Now, we've already gone through the process of installing the tax. If it's repealed, we're going to have to go through the burden of the expenditure all over again. We're going to have to repay the $1.6 billion. We're going to have to spend another $500 million just to revert it back. How could the government pay for that? At this point, is it really worth it to repeal the HSD?
The government, presumably, according to the so-called independent panel, has already collected $800 million more than what they said they were going to collect. So I guess they'll have no difficulty paying off the $1.6 billion. But aside from that, we've got to do what Quebec would do. We've got to negotiate with the federal government. The federal government collected an additional $200 million-plus in income taxes from this province that they wouldn't have collected without the HSD. So they're making money at it. They're a lot smarter than the people in Victoria. So we need to negotiate, but even if we had to pay the whole thing back, it's a cheap investment. $1.6 billion as opposed to $20 billion over 10 years, or $20 billion or much more over 10 years. Even if we had to pay it all back, it's a cheap investment.
Do you have any insights about some of these amendments that Premier Clark is talking about making to the tax?
I don't trust them. Obviously, we know that once the HSD is in, they can put it up or put it down. They can do what they did in Europe, where it's now averaging 20%, in some countries 25%, and it's on groceries and everything else. They could do that eventually. But in the meantime, for political purposes, they could also lower it a bit. But it's all politics. I don't believe it, and I'm going to fight them all the harder if they do that sort of stuff.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Van Der Zem. Have a good day. Your insight is always appreciated.
Okay.
Bill Van Der Zem is the former Premier of British Columbia, and he's also heading a campaign to get rid of the HST in this summer's referendum. For more information on Mr. Van Der Zem's campaign, you can visit fighthst.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, but stay with us. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to CITR News 101.
The Union presents Tech 9, Tuesday, May 24th at the Vogue Theatre. Known for his bar-setting live performances and unstoppable touring ethic, Tech 9 is an expanding force in the music industry, climbing charts and filling venues from coast to coast. Also hitting the stage will be Chris Calico and Scale Breakers. Tickets are available from Zulu Records, Livestock, Beat Street, and online at unionevents.com and tickets.voguetheater.com. Doors are at 7 p.m. and all ages are welcome. That's Tech 9 with Chris Calico and Scale Breakers. Tuesday, May 24th at the Vogue Theater. No teller with no hair to pay. Touche, get the party jumping. Keep the hotties humping. I like them thick and juicy, so don't Pilate nothing. Drinking too much, Lou, you might
be... All right, I'm not going to throw things to Free Speech Radio News on a story they did about public trust lawsuits supported by youth across the U.S. filed against the state governments to stop climate change. Here is that story. We'll be right back here.
In Greenland yesterday, the Arctic Council, that includes the US, Russia and Canada, signed its first legally binding agreement, which establishes policies for search and rescue operations. Members also discussed better ways of preventing and dealing with oil spills in that region. Observers say future agreements could include contentious issues like oil and gas exploration that are strongly opposed by environmental groups. For many years, Greenpeace has tried to protect the fragile Arctic environment where there's growing evidence of melting sea ice and retreating coastline. For more, we go to John Hosever, Greenpeace Oceans Campaign Director. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
The US is one of the Arctic Council members, which include the eight countries bordering the area and indigenous leaders. But this is the first time a US Secretary of State has attended this annual meeting. Do you see US interests growing in the region, and what are those interests?
It
does seem that U.S. interests are growing. The Arctic is one of the key pieces of President Obama's new national ocean policy, which is in draft. It seems like that what's really driving this is the U.S. trying to make sure that they get their piece of the oil and gas pie. And that's really unfortunate. You know, it seems like we're in a situation where all these countries are looking to take advantage of the melting sea ice and get access to oil and gas resources. And it's creating very considerable tensions between many of the Arctic nations.
In line with that, just before this meeting, WikiLeaks leaked a secret U.S. diplomatic cable that suggests the U.S., Russia and Canada are all now looking to stake their claims and exploit Arctic resources. Have you seen that cable, and are you surprised by that revelation? Sounds like you're probably not.
It confirms what we've known and suspected all along, and it's really disappointing, but not surprising. The U.S. has been moving down that road for many years, and many of the Arctic countries have been really saber-rattling for quite a while now, you know, increasing military exercises in the Arctic, which on the face of it seems absurd given how remote and, you know, really empty many of the areas are.
Arctic members yesterday signed the first legally binding agreement, and this one including on search and rescue operations, but they also discussed preventing and responding to oil spills, indicating that oil exploration is a priority for those council members. And days before this meeting, Greenland's government granted licenses to Cairn Energy to drill 4 offshore wells in the Arctic region. How much oil drilling is actually taking place in the Arctic now?
It's really just starting. There isn't any drilling in the U.S. Arctic Ocean, and there's a bid off of Greenland that's just begun, I think a little bit more in Norway. Russia is really looking to get involved quickly. The U.S., you know, they're considering plans to allow Shell and BP to drill in the Arctic Ocean as early as next year.
For many years now, Greenpeace, your organization, has been pushing for measures to defend the region from oil drilling, from destructive fishing, and increased commercial shipping. Did this meeting yesterday make any progress on any of those fronts?
I'd say it was a step backward. I mean, the agreements that came out of this are really not going to have any conservation benefit, at least not in any meaningful sense. And it, more than anything, signaled the desire of these countries to continue to move forward with their plans to drill in the Arctic Ocean.
So what sorts of controls and safeguards exist on drilling in the Arctic now, and what would you like to see in place?
Unfortunately, it's very minimal at the moment. Within territorial waters, each country has their own permitting processes. And as we've seen in recent years, unfortunately, with the Deepwater Horizon spill, those are clearly insufficient. On the high seas, really all that's been preventing drilling in the past has been that it's been covered by sea ice. And now that that ice is melting, there isn't any agreement in place that would prevent another disaster.
You mentioned that warming and a climate report that was issued by a working group of this council found that in the last 6 years it's been the warmest period ever recorded in the Arctic. Snow cover and sea ice are decreasing, and glaciers and ice caps are melting faster this decade than the previous one. The report also found that the Arctic Ocean could be mostly ice-free in late summer within the next 30 to 40 years. Is there a connection between climate change in the Arctic and oil drilling and consumption?
Absolutely, and that's a conservative estimate. Other scientists have predicted that the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free as early as 2020, so just a few years out. So, you know, it's a bit of an intelligence test for humanity, really, when on one hand, burning fossil fuels and our reliance on oil and coal has led to the global warming, which is melting the sea ice. Now that very outcome is making it possible for us to tap into even more oil and fossil fuels and further exacerbate the problem. You know, this is a key moment for us to realize that that's just not in any of our interests.
How would you like to see this Arctic Council respond to the concerns you have about climate change?
really it is on the Arctic Council and these nations to make a decision that it's not in any of our interests to allow drilling. And in fact, what we need is a treaty similar to what we have in the Antarctic, where the international community sets aside the Arctic as an area for peace and science. Otherwise, I think in addition to the fossil fuel problem and the risk of oil spills, we're going to see increased military tension between countries seeking to grab their peace.
John Hosever, head of the Greenpeace Oceans team, speaking to us from a busy Phoenix airport. Have a good trip, and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
And thanks to FSRN for that. I'm now joined by a member of the Independent Contractors and Businesses Association of BC for the flip side of the HST argument, Philip Hochstein. Philip, thanks for being with us. Philip? Are you with us here, Philip?
Hello.
There we go. Now we're getting it.
That's better, yeah.
Beautiful. How are you?
I'm good. You?
Oh, just fine. Getting better. So tell us, what are some of the benefits for the HST with regards to as far as the people of BC are concerned?
Well, then I think the key benefit is it makes our province a more efficient place to do business. And if it becomes more efficient, then it also creates jobs. So I think what it really means for the people of British Columbia are jobs. Job security that otherwise we wouldn't have.
How is it more efficient?
Well, it makes businesses' investment much more efficient, much more cost effective. You know, the forest industry said that it's the single biggest change the government could have done to help them in the world economy. Look, we're in a world economy, and we need to be able to be competitive. The HST, a value-added tax that exists in virtually all the other countries in the world, is something that we need here. And it would make us a very tax-efficient kind of jurisdiction. So it's important for everybody, especially those people who are looking for jobs in the small business community, and et cetera, to support the tax.
So you're saying it would simplify the system rather than separate the tax into the PST and GST. It just makes things easier to have it into the harmonized tax.
It does. And now, to add even more complexity to things, to have to go back to a system where there is a PST and GST to repay the money from the federal government, to rehire all the bureaucrats who are now working for the feds and to rehouse them, and just the cost and the difficulty of going back just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, that's one of the main arguments, I guess, because if the tax is repealed, not only are we going to have to pay that money back, but they're estimating about $500 million just to set up the offices and pay for the staffing to revert back to the old system. And at this point, it almost doesn't seem worth the burden.
It isn't worth the burden, and I think people, when Bill Van Der Zandt and all his acolytes were out there saying the world is going to end, the world is going to end when the HST came in. Well, we've been living under the HST, and the world has far from ended. And in fact, I think things are going to get better even as we go forward. You don't make tax policy and expect the world to change overnight. This is a long-term competitiveness issue for our province. So tax policy changes are not designed to work overnight. They have to take time. But I think Bill Van Der Zandt and his crowd was saying, everything would stop. Everything would go be so much more expensive. People would stop going to restaurants. People would stop buying houses. I don't know if you looked about housing sales in Vancouver, but they ain't stopping. And if you've been to a restaurant lately, they're full of people. So all those chicken little arguments just have proven to be false.
Well, used housing rentals, and actually sales for that matter, isn't something that's even affected under the HST, is it?
It isn't. You're right. For some houses up to $525,000, they're exempt from the HST, but above that, there is HST above that. So for some housing, it is. Certainly in the Lower Mainland, it's affected. I think outside the Lower Mainland, it's probably less affected.
Do you think there's much appeal to the Premier's talk about possibly amending the tax to make it a little more palatable for the people of BC?
I think a couple of things. One is people are very angry with the way it was brought in. And when people are angry, you can't give them facts about why they shouldn't be angry. You got to wait till they settle down. And I think with Gordon Campbell retiring and Carol James getting booted out by the NDP, people's anger began to dissipate. They are now much more prepared to listen. They are now much more prepared to give input into the kinds of things that need to be changed about the tax that would make it more supportable from some of the people. And I think the government is open to doing that. What those tweaks are, I'm not sure. But let me add this. If the government's going to reduce the take from the PST, from the HST, then they got to get it from somewhere else. Because the money that goes into universities and colleges and hospitals and schools and social services and housing for the less fortunate people, that money's got to come from somewhere. And the GST was bringing in more money to provide those services. So if we're going to take that away, we're either going to increase our debt and deficit, which is something that I don't think is supported, or we got to find other places to raise the revenue. So they can tweak the tax, but they got to do it and still balance the budget.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Phil.
Okay, happy to do it.
Yeah, have a good day.
Bye.
That was Philip Hochstein, member of the Independent Contractors and Business Association of BC, arguing for the HST. We're going to take a quick break here, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemelin.
The North by Northeast Festival, music, film, and interactive, takes over Toronto once again June 13th to 19th. North by Northeast showcases the best new music from around the world. Rock, hip-hop, punk, country, blues, electronica, singer-songwriter, and more. It's your chance to catch breakout performances from tomorrow's stars. 7 days, 50 stages, over 650 bands, plus 40 great music-related films. All this for just $50. Wristbands are on sale. Check nxne.com for details. Also available, passes that get you into the clubs first and into North by Northeast's groundbreaking interactive media conference. You want more? North by Northeast also rocks the heart of Toronto with 4 nights of massive free outdoor concerts. Visit nxne.com for tickets and up-to-the-minute festival info. North by Northeast, celebrating 17 years of great music.
All right, welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin. It's now time for your weekly weather forecast, and it's going to be brought to you by me. Tonight we're going to look at, it's going to be some clouds, 60% chance of showers, with a low of 7 degrees. Tomorrow is going to be cloudy with a mix of sun, about 30% chance of showers, with a high of 12 degrees. Tomorrow night, some more clouds, a low of 6 degrees. And Wednesday, cloudy, 14 degrees. But then, boy, does it ever explode into absolute gorgeousness. Thursday, it's going to be sunny with a high of 17 degrees. Friday, sunny with a high of 18 degrees. Saturday, mix of sun and clouds, high of 19. Same for Sunday, and that'll bring us into the newscast for Monday's beautiful newscast as well, although don't hold me to it because I am not a meteorologist. That is your weather forecast, and now we're going to go to the Arts Report with Adam Yanouz, who was talking about a $20,000 prize that a young lady won, and she's donated the entire check to the Vancouver Fringe Festival. Here's Adam with that report.
So just as David Jordan, the executive director of Vancouver's Fringe, was coming to terms with a deficit for this year's festival, something amazing happened. Capital One Canada and Canada Helps were doing a national awareness campaign highlighting charity fraud, and they did it by putting up a quiz that people could take online. One lucky quiz taker would get $20,000 to donate to their favorite charity. A woman by the name of Leanna Walden won that prize and decided to give it to the Fringe. Now, Leanna is no stranger to the Fringe. She's been a lifelong supporter and currently sits on its board. She heard about the contest from the Fringe Festival's Director of Development, Gareth Duncan. So earlier today, Gareth, Leanna, David, and the whole Fringe crew came together with the folks from Capital One and Canada Helps as the Fringe was presented with a giant novelty check. So here is Dion Youngblood, the senior business director from Capital One, explaining where the idea for this quiz came from. And also in this clip is David Jordan reacting to getting this much needed boost.
The idea really came from the need to educate the public on the risk of charity fraud, and we felt that was the best way to get that word out, and also kind of have a fun concept to allow the winner of the contest to choose the charity of their choice for the donation.
And just give us a quick idea of how it worked, like because there was one grand prize, but there were also smaller prizes.
Yeah, there were four smaller prizes, and then the grand prize, and people that took the quiz were entered in the draw, and then their names were selected, and they got to choose the charity of their choice.
What do you think of the Fringe, Vancouver Fringe winning it?
Oh, it's fantastic. I think it's great to be out here in Vancouver, and just really a lot of excitement and energy with the Fringe Festival, and just great to be a part of it.
David, let me ask you, how did you find out about this? Because it's not a typical way for an arts organization to discover they've got some money.
Well, our director of development was really responsible for bringing it to our attention. I get, you know, and we just recently hired our director of development. Before last year, we didn't have one. So that was, you know, wonderful that he was able to focus on something like this. It really would have sort of come in and out of my inbox, unfortunately. So it's wonderful to feel like we have the growing infrastructure to be able to support, you know, all aspects of charitable donations. So.
And in terms of being a victim of charity fraud, has the Fringe ever been involved in fraud, as far as you know?
Not that I know of, which is amazing, because we also, you know, fraud in general. We've moved, you know, we move a lot of money around around the festival. We use volunteers to do so. So I think it's a real testament to the group of people that we work that we've never had any issues. Although, you know, you really can't count on that. So, you know, we are trying to increase all of our levels of, you know, checks and balances and security. So, yeah.
And in terms of what impact $20,000 makes, is that just a drop in the bucket in terms of what the Fringe does, or is that a substantial sort of boost?
Well, it's coming just at the right time. We've had some provincial cuts to our budget. Next year we're going to be losing $70,000. We've managed to do a 3-year budget that will see us having a surpluses in year 1 and year 3. So the year 2 was the one where we were planning a deficit year. So this will actually, we were planning to have a deficit of $17,000. So this is literally going to plug the hole. So
that's fantastic. Congratulations.
It is fantastic. Yeah.
So David Jordan there, very happy with this donation of 20 grand, and Dion Youngblood from Capital One, also happy to give it to them, and why not? Also, we have one more interview for you, and that's with Leanna Walden, who was the angel, the donation money fairy, if you will, who generously decided to give it to the Fringe. So I asked her to tell us a story about how this whole thing happened and how she came to win.
First of all, I've been involved with the Fringe probably about 20 years, like on and off, as a volunteer starting when I was in university. And I've worked for the Fringe Festival, and now I'm on the board of the Fringe Festival. And so one of the employees was pushing this survey, sending it out to everybody, all the members, saying, hey, let's sign up for this. You know, it's very simple. It's an easy survey. And there's a possibility. I mean, we don't know, but what the heck. And it's actually a really good survey. Let's just do it. So I said, okay, I might as well do it. And it was easy, and it was good. It was informative, actually. And which was the point. Canada Health is trying to be informative there.
That's right.
And it was actually very informative. I mean, I knew a lot of the answers to the questions, of course, but it just brings awareness to charity fraud, basically. So that was it, and I forgot about it. And it asked you at the end to choose, if you were to win, what charity would you choose? And you know, I've been involved with the Fringe for so long. I'm like, okay, of course, the Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And
I got a call, and you won the grand prize. I guess they, at, they have other prizes. I don't know the levels of the other ones, but so I thought, well, okay, grand prize, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And he said, well, it's 20,000. 20,000, my God!
And apparently that comes at just the right time. It plugs a leak in the budget for the Fringe this year, so it was very timely that way.
Yes, it was.
Now, just tell me a little bit about the Fringe and why the Fringe. You said you've been involved with it for such a long time on so many different levels, and I just want to ask you a little bit about why that is. What is it about the Fringe versus any other arts organization that you feel makes it deserving of this and deserving of your, you know, participation?
First of all, I really like what the Fringe represents, and that is freedom of expression. And I think that's so important, and that's a really important aspect of Canadian culture. You know, we're a melting pot of all these cultures from all over the world, and we're trying to establish some kind of an identity. I think we have been trying for many years. We're young. We're very, very young, and it takes hundreds of years to establish identity. It takes numbers of generations to get to that point. And one reason why people do come to this country is because they know there is freedom in this country to express themselves, culturally, artistically, socially. I mean, you can be whoever you want, basically, in Canada and be accepted sexually, you know, all sorts of ways. So that is such an important aspect of the festival for me, is that these artists are given the opportunity to express themselves freely.
Right, there's no, the festival is unjuried and there's no, like, creative, artistic...
Exactly. There's nobody coming in telling them how to do what they do. I mean, besides, you know, besides the limitation of legality, they can do pretty much anything they want and express themselves any way they want. And that's changed over the years, and it really reflects the times, and it reflects what's going on in the country.
You mean the way that people choose to express themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've seen more sex in some of the plays at times, and then you see a lot less, and you might see more serious type of plays, and you might, or more political types. Yeah, exactly. And they're all expressing. I mean, the majority of the plays and the artists come from Canada, Vancouver's Fringe Festival from BC, and then there's a national section, but there's also an international section. So that's an important part of it too, where it brings together other artists from around the world, so you can share ideas and explore with each other. And they actually come together usually at every festival. At the end of the festival, a number of artists come together and they perform something together as a group, and that's also expressed in a free manner, unjuried manner. So I think that's just so important to me, that we as Canadians start to create an identity. And how do you do that but through our artistic means and a place where you can express freely?
Have you ever thought about having a Fringe show yourself?
Oh yeah.
Have you done it?
No, I haven't done it. I haven't done one, but you know, there are people that are in the Fringe that are 20, and there are people in the Fringe that are 70.
Exactly.
So you can be any age. That's the other thing. It's all inclusive. You know, it's not restricted to any age, any race, any anything. So maybe I will one day. I don't know. I haven't done that yet. So.
And that's Leanna Walden, who is contemplating her first Fringe production, maybe 2012. So there we have it. The Fringe Vancouver International Fringe Festival gets to live another day, as if they weren't going to. But they'll get to live another day a little bit smoother, a little bit more safer, on safer ground.
Well, thank you very much for that report, Adam. You'll never know how appreciative I am, I'm sure of it. Welcome back to CITR News 101. I am Martin Lemlin. That's our program for May 16th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Again, I'm Martin Lemlin from the entire news team at CITR. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.